Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. There's a pearl of Russian folk wisdom that says good fortune would never have materialized if it weren't for a misfortune. The war in Ukraine seems too grim and gruesome to think about anything positive coming out of it. But what if this dark cloud, or rather major geopolitical storm, also had a silver lining? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Steve Keen, an Australian economist and honorary research fellow at University College London. Professor Keen, it's great to talk to you. It's a fairly rare treat for me these days to speak to Western thinkers, so I'm particularly appreciative of that. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad to be invited, and particularly knowing this will be unedited. So anybody who sees this subsequently with a Western orientation, there has been no doctoring whatsoever of this conversation. And I can verify that.
I have to say that we promise that to all of our guests. So if any of the Western speakers want to come in on the show, they're more than welcome to do that. Now, when it comes to the current events in Ukraine, I think the Western party line or the predominant Western narrative is that, first of all, this aggression, and I have to admit that the military operation is a form of aggression, there is no way around it, but that these events, first of all, are totally unprovoked, and secondly, that they are unwarranted, that there are absolutely no strategic or geopolitical antecedents to Russia's actions. I wonder if that accords to your understanding of what is happening in Ukraine.
No, it doesn't. If I go back far enough, I wrote a paper way back in the early 2000s, late 90s, I think, called the Russian Defeat of Economic Orthodoxy. And in that, I went through the history of how particularly American economists had advised the American government and the Soviet, the Russian government as the Soviet Union collapsed, that the best way to transit from socialism to capitalism was to do it very quickly, what they called shock therapy. And I just went through how absurdly wrong those arguments were and how they would cause enormous suffering in Russia when it actually happened, and that this would set up both forces for the fragmentation and breakdown of Russian society, but also, of course, a reaction. So it was no surprise to me at all that you had a strong man emerge out of that, the farce of Yeltsin, which was, you know, a drunkard who was supported by the West, the absurdity of trying to go, first of all, in 500 days, then 150 days, and really effectively ultimately in one day, a transition from a socialist economy to a market economy was truly absurd. And the American economists were largely responsible for that, including Jeffrey Sachs, who I must say has improved his tone dramatically since then, fundamentally admitted his error. But the American government, and this is actually speaking from a conversation with Jeffrey Sachs, he said that he, when he got inside the State Department because of his economic role and he was talking about that transition, he realized that the State Department wanted to use it to destroy Russia. There was still this 19th century attitude.
Professor Keen, let's try to unpack that latest statement of yours, because, you know, one could argue that this was an unprecedented transition and nobody knows well ahead what's going to happen. I mean, when you have to sort of transform a country of Russia's size and build up, you know, mistakes are inevitable. But I remember that all the way until, I think, early 2000s, Russians had an ambiguously positive regard for the Americans. I mean, I remember growing up as a girl in Leningrad and dreaming about going to the United States as some sort of a magical land. And that attitude was shared not only by the ordinary folks, but also by the elites. Why do you think there was such a drastic reversal of regard, not only, let's say, in economic terms, but in people-to-people exchanges?
Yeah, well, I think it begins with the reason the Soviet Union failed. And the best analysis of that was done by the brilliant, recently deceased Hungarian economist Janos Kornai. And he talked about what he called supply constraint versus demand constraint, or resource constraint versus demand constrained economies, and did a beautiful analysis saying that a country which followed a socialist attitude where you try to provide maximum wages to workers and you were trying to grow the entire economy would always be resource constrained. And that would lead to duplication of last year's goods as the easiest way to produce output. And therefore, you didn't innovate. And that led to the, you know, people, I mean, in Russia salivating over Levi jeans, for example. So you had this aspiration for what you had in the West, but then the way it was given to you should have been the Marshall Plan. It should have been a socialist version of the Marshall Plan to reconstruct Russia and to bring its industry up to date with the industry in the West. Instead, you had this devastation of suddenly exposing you to Western competition. You had all this money saved up from the Soviet days when you waited 15 years for a television set, so you had a bank balance, and that was all gone in a matter of a pretty brief orgy of buying Western goods, and then industry collapsed. Nobody had jobs, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's what destroyed the attitude. And at the same time, as I say, to Jeffrey Sachs talking inside the State Department, the apparatchiks in the State Department, and they're every bit as bad as those in the KGB, were using this as a way of destroying a rival in a 19th century sense. So I think once this sank in with the Russian people, that sense of passion to involve with the West started to dissipate. And now you've got that Russian pride and also equally a justified anger at the West.
Mm-hmm. Now, I personally think that part of that disappointment is of our own making. I mean, we shouldn't have outsourced the leadership or, you know, economic guidance to any particular power. But when you say that the Americans wanted to destroy or undermine Russia as a rival, back in the 1990s, mm-hmm. early 1990s, Russia presented absolutely no threat to American hegemony. Why do you think the Americans didn't set aside their attempts to weaken Russia? I mean, what possible goal could it serve?
I really think it's pure ideology. I mean, you had, you know, Cold War, anti-Russian Cold War types who just could not really say, oh, suddenly Russia's no longer the Cold War. I mean, if you look back at the aftermath of the First World War, the attitude of the French to the Germans was to crush them through the Treaty of Versailles. And that's what led Keynes to write The Economic Consequences of the Peace, where he predicted the Second World War because of the way the Germans would respond to that. Now, in 1945, the lesson was learnt, and the American attitude was the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe. And of course, we see how that transformed Germany, made it a bastion of a Western capitalist attitude, got rid of most of the Nazi elements, not all, and that was successful. So I think in many ways, unfortunately, what the West did with the collapse of the Soviet Union was go back to the mentality of the French in 1918 and see it as ways permanently destroying a rival. And you simply can't do that in the modern world. The rival is still there. They will build up animosity as a result.
And I heard you say that a better option would be to come up with some sort of a Marshall Plan for Russia back in the early 1990s. But when the Americans came up with the original Marshall Plan for Europe, they didn't do that out of the goodness of their heart. They did that because it was strategically and geopolitically beneficial for them. What could be possible upsides for the Americans in seeing Russia, if not prosper, then at least, you know, being well-adjusted, let's put it this way?
Well, they would have become a recipient of American exports. American culture would have turned up as part of Russia in the way it did in Germany. So there are all these positive reasons to want to redevelop. But unfortunately, the people in control were still the old Cold War warriors, and they, in a way, it was like modern boxing. Rather than, you know, declaring a victory on points, you're there bashing your opponent into submission, and that attitude still continues. And I still see Americans talking about Russia as if they're talking about the Soviet Union and Joseph Stalin. And to me, it's just stunningly stupid. But that seems to be the supremacist attitude of Americans, which is what I see as the large part of the background of the rise of Putin and now, ultimately, unfortunately, the incursion into Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's very difficult to have those conversations without mentioning Zbigniew Brzezinski and his famous quote about Ukraine, that without Ukraine, Russia ceases to be an empire, but with Ukraine suborned and then subordinated, Russia automatically becomes an empire. As widely cited as it is, do you believe that it's actually true in this day and age?
Well, Ukraine is the agricultural food bowl of Europe. And people, I've only been to Ukraine a couple of times, but I have some awareness of that. The deepest topsoil possibly on the planet, incredibly fertile, and the biggest country in Europe. So for that reason, it's a huge component It's huge in its own right. It's a huge component of whatever bloc it belongs to. So, and Russia doesn't, is also quite an agricultural power, but nothing on the focus scale of Ukraine. So I can see that orientation. But clearly what I've experienced when I've been to Ukraine, and I think what we're experiencing now, is Ukraine is a nation well and truly apart from Russia. And that does not appear to be how Russians regard Ukraine. Certainly, I think the incursion wouldn't have been gone on the scale that it was if there was any recognition that Ukraine is a separate country. And so I think that's where I see the misstep coming from this invasion, as an attempt to completely reincorporate Ukraine into Russia. That wasn't what the Ukrainians had in mind, and I think we're now seeing the consequences of that.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that, because I'm seeing a lot of Russian, prominent Russian analysts, including those who are advising the Kremlin directly, speaking out in favor of preserving Ukrainian sovereignty. So that's
good.
That's,
I'm glad to hear that.
In Russia. But going back to that Zbigniew Brzezinski's idea of subordinated Ukraine, it's not like before this all began in 2013, 2014. I mean, before it came to its apogee, I should say, rather, because it began far earlier than that. It wasn't like Ukraine was particularly subordinated by Russia, because it was its trade with Russia. It was also earning a lot from its cooperation with the West. It essentially was having the best of both worlds. Why do you think that sort of balance, economic, political, diplomatic, wasn't sustainable?
I think it was sustainable if NATO respected the desire and the sensible desire for Russia not to have a hostile power right on its border. And this is what the part that I saw as provocation by NATO. At one stage, there was a recording of Putin saying that he actually asked Clinton whether Russia could join NATO. Now, if Clinton had said yes, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So NATO could have become a trans-European, almost trans-European Asian collaboration. Instead, it became this continuation of the Cold War when you didn't have a Cold War rival. So I think that provocation of saying, you know, we're trying to get countries on the border of Russia to join, and that's why I always regarded that as this has been the provocation America said. America did not exactly enjoy having Cuba on its border, and in many ways, this is a repeat of that. Even though it's unfair to a small country to be told you can't have an independent foreign policy because you bought a major power, that's real politics. And if NATO has respected that and not tried to encourage Ukraine to join NATO, then I think this incursion wouldn't have happened.
But Professor Kinn, it's not about not having an independent foreign policy. They could have a fully independent foreign policy manipulating or playing Russia off the West, but it's just
where they're neutral.
The military aspect should have been given more thought.
Now, I think so, true.
One of the ideologues of the American policy in Ukraine, Francis Fukuyama, a person who spent a lot of time in Kyiv lately, wrote recently that at this point there is no conceivable compromise that would be acceptable both to Russia and Ukraine, given the losses that they sustained. And he went even further to foretell of a sudden and catastrophic collapse, not only of the Russian troops, but also of Vladimir Putin's government. Do you think that's likely?
It's always hard to say it's going to happen inside the Kremlin, but I think in terms of the military incursion into Ukraine, yes, that's quite possible. First of all, the ferocity with which Ukrainians are fighting back is the typical ferocity of an invaded people. You probably remember the exchange between McNamara and his equivalent in Vietnam after the Vietnam War, when McNamara was coming up with body counts and saying, if we get enough dead Vietnamese, we'll win the war. And I've forgotten the name of it. His counterpart in the Vietnamese administration. But you see, you don't realize we would have fought to the last dead Vietnamese. Now, I think a similar thing is happening in Ukraine. And of course, at the same time, the West is supplying them with weapons to enable them to continue that battle. And of course, they're capturing Russian weapons as well. I think this is interminable. Now, if that turns up as meaning that in the Kremlin, people think this is just impassable, we have to get out of this somehow, and Putin can't do it, then maybe there will be a palace coup in the Kremlin. But I'm not going to put any money on either of those outcomes.
But what about the opposite? Do you think the Zelensky government or even the Biden administration could be threatened by the way things are unfolding in Ukraine and around Ukraine?
No, again, I think Zelensky surprised people. I have quite a few people, friends on the left who push the anti-Ukrainian, there are Nazis in Ukraine, even though Zelensky's Jewish, and that sort of line at me. And say, look, he's got a apartment, he's got a house in Florida you can go to, he's got millions here, billions there, et cetera, et cetera. He didn't leave. And I think that was an act of an incredible personal courage for somebody in that situation. And you look at it and think, that is what unites people. And this is a bit like if you look at Churchill again, the same sort of crazy stuff that Churchill went through. Nonetheless, when he said, we will fight them on the beaches, we will never surrender, that defined the British response to the Nazis. And I think in that sense, Zelensky, whatever you might say about him, to criticize him for the internal, the fact that he didn't leave and took the risk of being killed by Russian attacks and so on, that has solidified the country around him. And again, Churchill didn't survive the Second World War. Maybe Zelensky won't, but I think he'll certainly survive the conflict.
We have to take a short break. Professor Kinney, we'll be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Steve Keen, an Australian economist and honorary research fellow at University College London. Professor Keen, before the break, we talked about whether the survival of the Putin or Zelensky government could be threatened by the conflict in Ukraine. But I heard you propose an even more radical idea that this conflict could also lead to the end of the US dollar as the main reserve currency for international trade. What makes you believe that is possible, and why would that be a good thing?
Well, I mean, this is one of the many mistakes America's made internationally. It should never have made itself the reserve currency. And Keynes was very explicit about this when he drafted his proposals for the Bretton Woods Agreement. He wanted to have an international currency called the bancor formed. And the idea of the bancor was that every country would get issued bancors relative to the size of their economies. And then trade would have to occur in bancors. And of course, if you're running a trade deficit for long enough, you could run out of bancors, and that would then force you to devalue. Equally, I would, you know, if you were accumulating them, you'd be forced to revalue. And there would be a tax as well, which would then be paid to developing countries. This was all intended to breach the pre-war experience of twofold. First of all, huge trade deficits, huge trade surpluses. And secondly, because the British pound was the pre-Second World War global currency, the British pound was valued well above the value of its own exports. You needed the pound not just to buy British goods, but also to be able to do trade, because trade was in British pounds. Now, the Americans replicated that mistake. This was Harvey Dexter White who pushed that at Bretton Woods. And that was American triumphalism. And so frequently, as they say, pride cometh before a fall, that was a stupid move. So what it meant was the American dollar after the Second World War became the overvalued currency. The financial sector in America became extremely strong and dominant. I think it's a major reason for the pathetic state of the global economy now. American manufacturing suffered. We ultimately saw that being outsourced to the third world, globalization and so on. If we'd had an international currency, a lot of these symptoms of the post-war malaise would not have occurred. So I've been in favor for a long time of a global currency, which Russia and China were working towards.
I just want to stress this point because I find it very surprising, but also very well articulated that most of people around the world believe that the US dollar is a major source of American power, but it also comes at a cost to the American society, to the American manufacturing, and ultimately to the American way of life. Now, do you think those imbalances that have been created because of that fateful decision back in the 1940s, do you think there is a strong enough impetus to, you know, to try to balance them out? Do you think the Americans would ultimately agree to relinquishing that power? Because it's not only a source of a major geopolitical and economic strength, but also, you know, a source of their self-perception of themselves as the leader of the world. There is a huge psychological factor there as well.
And I think that's dominant, unfortunately. If you actually sat down and did a cold, dispassionate analysis, as Keynes did, you'd say it'd be stupid to make yourself the international currency. It comes at those huge costs. Your financial sector becomes very powerful, but you weaken your manufacturing sector, you weaken your working class, and so on. And ultimately, it will cause a decay from the outside, which is what happened to Britain. Britain is now a deindustrialized country. America has not gone so badly because it's so much bigger, but the same basic trend is there. So dispassionately, yes, you'd get rid of it. But the extent to which Americans want to be the empire, that has trapped them into that mindset, and they would feel like, you know, like they had the balls cut off if they had to let the American dollar cease being the international currency. In fact, that'd be giving them some balls, because then they could actually, at a manufacturing power, they could start competing once more.
But as you mentioned, you know, those imbalances are so huge that I would suppose that correcting them would be impossible without major social disturbances or even perhaps upheavals. You would have to restructure not only the economy, but also the American way of life, the American way of consumption, etc. What do you think is more potentially dangerous, leaving things as they are or actually trying to change them?
Leaving things as they are, because what we haven't spoken about so far is climate change. And what we're seeing is the beginning of climate breakdown. And the scale of this is going to be far greater than what politicians expect, because they have been, just like the Russians were misled by American economists at the transition, the globe is being misled by American economists about what climate change means. So, for example, in the most recent 2022 Working Group 2 report by the IPCC, on chapter 16, page 65, you'll find the economist saying that a 4-degree increase in temperature will reduce global GDP by between 10% and 23% compared to what it would be in the absence of climate change. Now, that's trivial. That's less than a 0.1% fall in annual growth rate between now and 2100. Climate scientists are telling us they expect a breakdown of the climate that will jeopardize the possibility for sedentary human civilization at less than 2 degrees. So that is going to be the crunch which is coming our way and will force all these things to change. A major part of it will be what production does occur. We'll have to be much more regionally and domestically based. Globalization is dead. So that is, I think, the cataclysm coming our way. And the real issue for me is whether human society can hold together through it.
Professor King, but it almost, you know, the way I take it is that, you know, the ball is still in the American court, but the Americans are constrained by their 4-year election cycles and the very steep political polarization. Do you think there is enough political foresight or even strategic, you know, humanistic foresight to actually, you know, embark on some of those changes that you're talking about? Because, you know, for a person who is there in office for 4 years, serving the party line, that seems like not just a monumental challenge. I mean, that's a superhuman challenge to some extent.
It is superhuman. And I think the American political system is completely inappropriate for that sort of change. The extent to which Americans play this word freedom. I mean, I went to a tennis match in Philadelphia some years ago between a team of John McEnroe and Billie Jean King's teams. And between every point, they chanted out the word freedom. It is ludicrous how brainwashed they are in thinking they're a free society. So that means fragmentation to me. I think the only societies that have a chance to hold together under these pressures are ones which have a sense of national cohesion and agreement to a national principle. And that's countries like China, frankly, rather than countries like America or indeed now Russia.
Now, going back to the status of the US dollar, for the time being, it remains and it allows the Americans to use their currency as essentially a bullying tool in their sanctions wars, which I think we would both agree reach the apogee with the sanctions against Russia, not only because they are unprecedented in scale, but they are also unprecedented in terms of their effects on third countries. How long do you think the Americans will be able to sustain that, not vis-a-vis Russia, but vis-a-vis the price that the rest of the world is paying for the American decision?
Unfortunately, longer than I'd like to. I mean, what tends to happen is these things last longer than you expect and then fall apart all at once. So I think that hegemony will be very, very dominant until we start seeing serious climate breakdowns. And then in that situation, the countries that are going to be able to survive are those that have their production domestically sited. Now, that means China, and I hate to say this, with the sole exception of the capacity to produce integrated circuits, which is done by Taiwan. So I'm worried that that particular issue will mean China will decide to integrate Taiwan, which will be even scarier than what's happened with Ukraine. But only when you can operate all your manufacturing capabilities domestically do you have a chance of survival. And that means America will continue down this trade of trying to use their financial power to exploit the rest of the world and then have it fall apart and not have the local manufacturing capabilities. China, on the other hand, will have those capabilities.
You know, one of the upsides of Western speakers boycotting Russian media and RT in particular is that I get a chance to speak to a lot of people from around the world, and many of them are not just critical, they're sort of seething with anger at the American disregard of how American policies affect them, and especially, you know, the most vulnerable societies in Africa, who are genuinely facing a threat of not only mass hunger, but also unemployment, social upheavals, et cetera. You know, like they already had a lot of problems prior to that, and they seem to be multiplying very fast right now. When you think about that, do you think the Americans failed to price that in, the effect on the rest of the world? Or did they consciously decide that, you know, the world can deal with it?
No, I think that's, I've had expression ever since I've been a teenager that America suffers from the parochiality of empire. And that is, if you're an empire, you tend to regard the rest of the world as your backyard. And you decide if weeds grow in the backyard, you've got a right to go and pull them out. Now, frankly, that's what Putin is doing with Ukraine. But America does it on a global scale. They simply do not appreciate how the rest of the world has a legitimate right to think differently about the house to the backyard. So as being an Australian has actually given me a very interesting perspective there. And I've seen it in comparison to left-wing academics I know in America who believe stuff that I think is just delusional, because largely they can't see the rest of the world except through an American lens.
And finally, I heard you describe this current events as a classic 19th century great power conflict for more or less influence. And I wonder if you could possibly suggest any solution to that rivalry in the 21st century.
Oh, God. I mean, I think what has to be said is simply a decision to say, we won when pull out, and then try to negotiate some sort of split of the regions which are peripheral to both countries, the Donbass region and things like that. Perhaps even concede Crimea to get Donbass. I mean, I know Crimea was given by, I think, by Khrushchev to Ukraine as some ridiculous gesture in the 60s, and that was nonsense. It should have stayed part of Russia. But some sort of horse trading, because otherwise, if you don't do it, the animosity and the capacity for retaliation between these two countries will last indefinitely. So something which involves a loss by both countries.
Okay. Well, Professor Kinn, we have to leave it here. Thank you very much for your time. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. And thank you for, you know, not only your candor, but also, you know, your ability to speak to us.
Thank you. I enjoyed being asked. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.